to Steve Wicker, Professor of Electrical and Computing Engineering. You're all aware of the topic today, but what we're going to do is Steve is going to have a brief presentation, and then we'll open it up to informal question and answer and conversation. So, Steve?
Excellent. I'm looking forward to the conversation the most. But anyway, thanks for coming. I'm going to do what I love to do the most, which is tell you about my research, but I'll put it into context first. And basically what I'm going to talk about is this idea of metadata, a term I don't particularly like, and I'll explain why. And I'll talk about cellular privacy and the potential end of surveillance, the development of technologies that will be surveillance-free. Four basic points that I want to try and convey and look forward to your comments on. First, cellular, as we all know, is a critical platform for personal expression. There's actually more to it than that, though. It's become the platform, and I'll say a little bit about that as we get started. Secondly, metadata. Many people have said, literally, don't worry, it's only metadata. I'll talk about what metadata actually is and then try and convince you that it's actually something to worry about. In fact, the metadata can actually reveal more about your preferences, beliefs, and actions than the actual content of your calls. So there's a lot to be said about metadata. I'm going to note that it aids what I call correlation attacks on anonymous databases, and I'll say something briefly about an information theory of privacy that we're developing. I then want to get into some of the details of what's going on today, and in particular how this combination of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and the USA Patriot Act are basically obsolete. In combination, they're being applied today in ways that are dramatically changing the balance of privacy versus security in favor of security and against privacy. It simply does not take into account the way our systems actually work today. And then finally, and at least I'll admit for me the most important part, I'll get into some of our ongoing work in surveillance-free cellular. It's a very real possibility, and apparently the federal government's doing everything it can to create a market for surveillance-free cellular.
Did you say the government is?
Yes. In other words, by conducting such surveillance, they've got a lot of people interested in finding a way to make surveillance-free cellular so that it can't be tapped. It can't be. It won't collect data, and I'll get into that in some detail. But do feel free to ask.
I mean, doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose of what the government is trying to do?
It does.
Okay.
There's a backlash.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, we see it every day. You write about it. Other folks write about it. It's basically making people more and more aware of privacy. Privacy is a very nonlinear effect. And as people become more and more aware of it, they want it. It becomes an actual asset that people are going to be looking for. The markets are created, and people will move in and fill those markets. A few quick words about cellular in general. Something I call cellular convergence. It's the convergence of many, many different kinds of electronic communication onto a single platform. Cellular is far more than voice. Of course, we all know that. It's texting, email, web browsing. It just goes on and on. Location-based services, one of the most recent applications, and also one of the most privacy-concerning for some of us. It's a major platform for speech of all types. We're about to hit 6 billion cell phones in use. There are more cell phones in use in the world than there are flush toilets. It's an amazing number. Literally, virtually every man, woman, and child, including these folks I met in Tanzania at Olduvai Gorge. Okay, so clearly it's an important platform, so it's important to note that it's a surveillance technology. In fact, cellular has been a surveillance technology almost from the outset. First generation, 1983, United States cell phones had the ability to keep track of where their users were in order to route incoming calls. It was a solution to an engineering problem, but one that had long-term consequences. We'll say a little bit more about that. Now, what about this idea of metadata? Let's get into the issue of NSA surveillance. We've been told over and over again not to worry. It's only metadata. In fact, I'm quoting Senator Feinstein here, where she said, and this is actually unfair to quote someone who's talking off the cuff, so it comes out a little agrammatical, but gets the idea across. As you know, it's just metadata. There is no content involved. So she's creating that distinction between metadata and content. And we don't have to worry about this collection because it's not content that's being collected. Should you feel better? I would argue, no, you should not feel bitter. It's still a significant problem. Now, this distinction between content and metadata actually goes way back. In fact, I want to show you that it's embedded in law. Metadata is actually a bad term. Technically, it means data about data. It's not very informative. So I like to use content and context because that was the set of terms that was used as we go back into Fourth Amendment law in some cases that reach back almost 40 years. The best analogy for content and context that I've come across is the postal mail analogy. You write a letter to your mom and mail it. The content is the actual letter. It's what you've written and put in the envelope. The context data is the information on the outside of the envelope that makes the communication happen, that allows the postal network to route that letter from you to your mom. Okay, so it's got your address, mom's address, but it's got additional information too that you may not think about. It's got a postmark. Postmark has a location. It's got a time. So there's some additional stuff, context information, on the outside of that envelope. So that's our clear distinction here. Metadata is context data. It's data about the context in which communications take place. Now, this is an important distinction to us because it's embedded in law. The key case is Miller versus the United States from 1976. Miller was a modern-day bootlegger. He was avoiding his taxes. He had a fire in his warehouse. The firemen came to put it out, and they saw lots of big bottles of bourbon that didn't have tax stamps. The firemen told the police. The police went to Miller's bank. They asked for his deposit slips and canceled checks. This is the old days. They didn't just look it up on the web. They used the information from the checks to get a warrant. And then they searched the warehouse, found a still. Miller was convicted. He appealed and eventually made it to the Supreme Court, saying that the access to the bank records was a violation of Miller's Fourth Amendment rights. It was an unreasonable search and seizure. Well, the court said no. Okay, they applied a test from the Katz, actually, they applied what became the test in the Katz case. Basically, what Justice Powell said was that the checks are not confidential communications. All of the documents obtained, including financial statements and deposit slips, contained information voluntarily conveyed in the ordinary course of business. And that's the language that we're hanging on today, some 30-something years later, because we're voluntarily giving information up when we use the internet, for example, when we make cellular phone calls. And at least in theory, since we're doing it voluntarily, we have no Fourth Amendment rights in this information. This is what's called the third-party doctrine. The third-party doctrine basically says, and I'm quoting Professor Kerr now, knowingly revealing information to a third party relinquishes Fourth Amendment protection in that information. Now, he actually changes the word voluntarily to knowingly, which of course makes a little bit of a difference, but we'll simply work with that and note that we give up a lot of information when we use a particular communication technology. When you write email, when you use your cell phone, and of course we're now using our cell phone for just about everything, we are giving up a huge amount of information in the process of conducting that communication. Now, we can talk about whether we're doing it knowingly or not. I would suggest that the vast majority of people who use their cell phone have no idea how it works. Perfectly fine. I doubt they're knowingly giving up this information. Okay. Now, that particular doctrine, that distinction between content and context, where context receives less protection, is embedded in the ECPA. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act has three basic parts, and these parts have embedded in them that critical distinction. Title I is the Electronic Communications in Transit portion. It requires a warrant, what's called a Rule 41 warrant. This is the protection for voice over a cellular phone, for example, voice from your home phone, etc. The second title is for stored electronic communication. Say a little bit more about this when we get to the Patriot Act, but this is a second level of protection, a lower level. For stored electronic communication, law enforcement has to go before a judge and provide specific and articulable facts showing that the information is relevant and material to an ongoing investigation. In other words, an argument has to be made that the judge is willing to buy, that this is relevant to an ongoing investigation. So that's certainly a lower level than a warrant, which requires probable cause that a specific individual has basically done one or more crimes on a specific list.
So is that like an NSO letter then, basically?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Exactly. In fact, the letters would be equivalent to Title I. We do have judges that have to issue them. Cause has to be made. But I'm going to argue it's actually a lower level when we get to the Business Records Clause. And then finally, the PIN Register Act, as it's sometimes called, Title III, has virtually no protection. All right. This is also called the PIN Register Trap and Trace Devices. PIN registers collect the numbers that you dial. Trap and trace devices collect the numbers dialing in. Okay. This basically requires that law enforcement certify that the information is relevant. The appropriate law enforcement official has to certify. All the judge does is make sure that the right signature's on the form. Okay, so that's a very low level of protection. It's very easy to get a PIN register, as opposed to very difficult to get a warrant and a wiretap. All right, well, as you know, the Patriot Act modified ECPA in a number of ways. And it is, of course, an acronym. And I can never remember what all those letters stand for. But that's why it's capitalized. I want to focus on Section 215 because that's been in the news a great deal recently. It's the basis for the NSA's collection of all cellular phone records in the United States. And I'll leave it at that. It amends the ECPA. And basically what it states is that the FBI may require the production of any tangible things. It goes on to say, including books, records, papers, documents, and other items for an investigation to protect against international terrorism. All right. Now, the person who actually wrote this, or at least whose office wrote it, the senator who was involved, said he didn't mean for this to apply to cellular records, but that's where we are. And a judge, a very capable judge, has written a legal justification as to how this language applies to all that cellular data. But that justification is a secret. And that puts us in a strange position because it leaves those of us who haven't seen it wondering, is there something wrong with it? Well, probably not. A very capable legal officer drafted it. There may be reasons not to make it public, but it's a bad thing, I think, to have your legal justification hidden, right? It'd be nice to know. Okay. Well, the last thing I want to talk about before I get into the research issues and where we'd like to go from here, where we may go from here, is the fact that this metadata is highly revealing. Now, we've been doing a fair amount of research in a number of contexts, taking data sets and trying to figure out what can we show from this. Just an example, we collected power consumption data on a minute-by-minute basis from a grad student's apartment. We were able to predict everything that went on in that apartment. We got his permission, of course. But this kind of data is very revealing. And so imagine what is being collected by your cell phone and your service provider, your networks of friends, acquaintances, medical, legal contacts, supposedly anonymous sources, I suppose, in your business. Hopefully you don't use your cell phone for that. And it's the location data in particular that we've been focused on because that is highly revealing, especially as the location granularity has gotten down to the address level. That's also a highly nonlinear effect. If I know what addresses you've been at throughout the day and over the course of the week, I know a great deal about you. In fact, I know more about you than if I'd listened in on all your phone calls. Okay? It's not hard to imagine. Now that's by itself. In conjunction with other data, metadata becomes actually more of a problem because this can be used to de-anonymize databases that are supposedly anonymous. So the existence of this data is a problem, its use is highly problematic, and the bottom line is we should be very concerned when people collect metadata. There should be very good reasons for it. It's not enough to say, don't worry, it's not content. Okay. All right. So this is where we stand as a technical person, as someone who develops new technologies with my colleagues and my students at Cornell. I think we're reaching the point where we can say enough is enough. We're not getting public discussion of policy. We have to cope with secret legal interpretations that seem to run counter to our lay understanding of the law and what we see with our analysis of various data sets. Perhaps more important from an economic standpoint, a lot of people are losing faith in their service providers, in Google, in Facebook, in these large corporations that seem quite willing to hand over our personal data. And frankly, those of us who develop technologies are annoyed because what we're doing is being exploited. There are a number of people, old internet pioneers, one of whom was recently in the news talking about the fact that he was thoroughly annoyed that the World Wide Web is being exploited in this way and that encryption in particular is being toyed with because it's breaking trust. The trust, for example, that lies at the heart of e-commerce. This is a very serious thing, and we shouldn't be doing it just because we can. Now, what's being done here is people are getting annoyed, and we're creating a market. We're creating a vacuum that technical people are going to fill. And that vacuum takes the form of a call for surveillance-free technologies, and in particular, surveillance-free cellular. Because, as I mentioned at the very beginning of this presentation, the cellular handset is a phenomenal technology, and it's subsuming all of our electronic communications. It's extremely important for political reasons, for economic reasons, and so forth. And so a surveillance-free handset is going to be very important. How do we get there? Well, there is a roadmap. It starts with public key cryptography, which already lies at the heart of e-commerce. It makes e-commerce possible. It's why we're, maybe not happily, but it's why we're willing to give up our credit card numbers when we buy a book on Amazon. But there's other things going on as well. Unlicensed spectrum. The FCC some time back said that certain portions of the spectrum can be used for unlicensed communication with some relatively limited restrictions. For example, power level and such. But you don't have to ask permission. You can just use it. This is what current Wi-Fi technology is built on. Okay, the entire Wi-Fi, or you may know it as 802.11, industry is built on unlicensed spectrum. It was a brilliant idea. It's worked well. Well, we can use that spectrum for whatever we wish, including surveillance-free cellular. And then finally, open source development. I'll say a little bit more about that before we wrap up. But I simply want to note that there are a number of examples of excellent technologies that have been developed in the open. Linux is probably the best example. Now, open source, to come up with something surveillance-free, it seems almost paradoxical. It's really not. If you've got an open source device, you can't hide anything in that device. You can't hide software, malware, whatever the case may be, spyware. So let's say, and here's my shameless plug for my book, I had to do it. Public key crypto and anonymous cellular. One of the things we've shown in our research is that it is possible to create a system in which a user of a mobile device proves to their service provider that they're a valid user, that they've paid their bills, and can access that system without saying who they are. Right? So the key idea here was to separate tracking of the handset from tracking of the user. In other words, to take identity away from the handset. And without going into the gory details, basically we have a random string of numbers associated with a handset. And so with what we call a zero-knowledge proof, we show that that string of numbers is associated with a paid account, and then we can use it. But the service provider has no way of connecting the data associated with that handset to any individual. Okay? Pretty straightforward idea, at least it was straightforward after we came up with a solution, and this can be used in the development of a new cellular technology. Secondly, I mentioned the unlicensed spectrum. It actually works very well for cellular data. Our cellular service providers prove that every day, because as you know, cellular handsets have been used for a number of different activities that the service providers didn't anticipate, watching movies, for for example. And it's really loaded down their very expensive cellular spectrum. And so what the cellular service providers have been doing is offloading this content through Wi-Fi. You may think it's really wonderful that you can use Wi-Fi on your phone. Well, your service provider thinks so too, right? Because your service provider can use that connection basically to pump lots of information for free into their wired network through that short wireless distance from you to an access point, and they don't have to use their expensive spectrum. It's worked really well. Well, as it's set up now, the key terms are UMA. Another name for it is GAN, which is an indecipherable acronym. Most people know it as unlicensed mobile access. Takes you back into the cellular provider's network. Well, there's no reason for us to do that. We don't have to go back to the cellular provider's network. We can just go out onto the internet and collect data, have a call, whatever we wish. And what that does is it eliminates the collection of the metadata, if you will. Now, what about this idea of transparent equipment design? Open source development has a rather long history now. It started with Richard Stallman in the development of the general public license. It's a great idea. In 91, Linux got its start with Linus Torvalds' work. It's been proven very successful. In fact, there are Linux-based handsets. But the Linux in the handsets operates at higher layers. It interfaces with applications. It doesn't do all the stuff that's generating the metadata. Well, what I'm suggesting is why not open up the entire handset to open source development so that we can see everything that's going on and we can detect any software that might be recording things we don't want recorded. Now, I don't know if you're familiar. There was an incident 2 years ago now. Carrier IQ was a company that was collecting data for cellular service providers. And I talked to a chief engineer at one of the service providers, and he said that data was actually very useful. It helped them find holes in their network, helped them figure out where to set up their next tower. But the problem was that that software was in every hand or many handsets, and it was hard to detect, impossible to remove, and they created a public relations problem for themselves when people got the idea that this software was actually collecting keystrokes. It was capable of doing that. It was capable of collecting passwords as they were typed in. There's no evidence they were doing that, but it gave a bad impression. So Carrier IQ had some problems. There will be no possibility of such an issue coming up with open source development. The bottom line is that privacy is becoming a commodity. As every day we get more news, more revelations. Privacy is becoming something that's in the forefront of many people's minds. And of course, it becomes a commodity. We're creating a vacuum that people will attempt to fill with things like I've been discussing. The federal government has created a market, not willingly, but they have. So business models based on security and privacy are going to be a big deal going forward, and more so as time goes on. And what I have considered in some of our work is the idea of a location server that solves the problem of routing to mobile devices that's based on the same model of VeriSign and Symantec's business. Symantec bought VeriSign a while back. But basically, it serves as a PKI, public key infrastructure, that manages keys securely and promises monetary rewards if there's a security breach. This is part of what keeps e-commerce going. You can look at these certificates when you buy something from Amazon. I'm suggesting we can expand this to cover privacy issues, for example, location data and so forth. Okay. Bottom line, there's a growing market. There are technical solutions. Some very interesting problems that are already attracting some smart people and a lot of fun work to do, but it's clearly a well-defined road that people are willing to take. We could go all the way. We could have surveillance-free technology, or we could have more transparency in our current processes and still leave a role for law enforcement. But back doors that we're not aware of, collecting data without telling us, that's a bad idea. And that's it. Any questions?
Are there any companies that you're aware of that are working on this, that are close to coming out with something like this, or is there something out there in the marketplace?
In terms of the surveillance-free cellular, there are different researchers and groups looking at it, but no companies that are actually marketing devices yet.
How far down the road, you know, do you think something would go to market on something like this?
If we started working hard today, and I hope I'm already working hard, it would be on the order of 2 years, okay. 2 to 3 years.
And you started out by saying that the government is actually supportive of surveillance-free technology, right?
Oh, no. Okay. So, no, what I was saying was that they were creating the market,
okay.
But they're doing so inadvertently.
Right. I mean, this isn't helping them at all. They would...
No, they wouldn't like it.
Right. So I assume that some of this R&D is supported with government funds, right? I mean, is this at all a threat to those monies?
It's an interesting question. Some of this work is being supported by the NSF, the National Science Foundation. I'm not aware of DARPA supporting any of it. It could be a problem going forward. It depends on how the government reacts to these kinds of ideas. In the past, the government has continued to support crypto research. The NSF has, anyway. And the NSA has stopped trying to block, as far as I know, ongoing crypto research. They're now doing things another way. So I don't know. I would hope not.
So to,
it's nice to have my funding.
Yeah. yeah, I'm not advocating that. So to if these devices were built without this software, the malware, the spyware, all of this, mm-hmm. it would to some extent eliminate some of the services that clients get, right? I mean, location devices like GPS or whatever, that would no longer be available, correct?
No. In fact, but it's a good point. Let's think about GPS and how it's used in mapping functions and whatnot. In some of our research, we've shown that you can have privacy-aware location-based services. What you do is you try and keep the location estimate as coarse as possible, and in particular, try and avoid that nonlinearity that occurs when you go to an address level of granularity. In other words, we know we're somewhere in near Capitol Hill, mm-hmm. But we don't know we're in this building. Mm-hmm. And that's actually enough to save a great deal of privacy. And putting the user in control.
In this building or this building? Like this, when you say in this building, do you mean like this room or in this building specifically?
Well, that would be pretty fine granularity.
Yeah.
But certainly on this floor or in this building, that's what's done now. What I'm suggesting is that we don't need that. In other words, we can, to get a map, we can simply say, all right, we're somewhere in the vicinity of Capitol Hill. My phone will know where I am, but it's not going to tell anyone else. Mm-hmm. And so it can take that gross data and then give me a fine detailed map. So we really wouldn't have to give up much of anything. What we'd have, though, is more control over our data. And at least in my case, I'd be more willing to use some of these functions if I knew exactly what my phone was giving up.
And the phone's not giving up that data because it physically cannot, or because that data isn't connected to you since it's kind of an anonymous client with the server?
With regard to the location-based service, we know from looking at the software that the phone's not giving up the fine granularity data. With regard to the tracking, in other words, the ability of the network to route a call to me, I know from its design, if it's developed open source, that they don't know it's me. In other words, when they route that call to that long string of random numbers, they don't know it's me.
You may be being a bit over-optimistic. I mean, we heard about encryption and Tor and all that, and
yeah.
the government being able to sort of crack that code. And you know, it's sort of like saying, well, you can build a lock that nobody can break through, but somebody mm-hmm. can presumably break it if they had the wherewithal to do it.
It's a very good point. We do know that you can design a crypto system such that the exhaustive search would take far too long, even for the NSA. Mm-hmm. If your key is long enough and you can show that an exhaustive search is required, it will be secure. Okay. That can be done. In fact, that's why the NSA has been working with some companies to develop backdoors to their encryption technology, as opposed to doing whatever it is they do when they do an exhaustive search. I think that was in the news just in the last few days. Mm-hmm. So clearly, you know, simply overpowering it with computational effort is not enough in some cases, and so they want these backdoors. If it's an open source crypto development, there won't be a backdoor, because we could see it.
I don't promise, or I don't claim to be an expert on this by any stretch. I am not a tech person, but it seems to me that in some of these encryption systems that the key is known by more than one person, i.e. the person who's giving the client the key will probably know who that client is, no? I mean, couldn't the government compel that that third party to give up the key to the encryption?
If there was a third party holding the private keys, the keys that would perform the decryption, yes. In fact, we've seen examples with that in a recent case where an email provider decided to go out of business rather than to continue to cough up the data. But with regard to some of the systems we're looking at, you can have a computational device that generates the key pair for public key cryptography. One is for encryption, and you can make that public. The other is for decryption, and you keep it secret. It never has to leave your handset. You can have it in something called a cryptographic vault so that any attempt to recover that number would destroy it. So that's certainly possible. Now, the question is, how do I go about distributing the encryption key? That's where the VeriSign type solution comes in. You allow them to help distribute the encryption key, but you don't let them have the decryption key. That was the problem with the email service that got in trouble, is their decryption keys were being held locally, and so they were subpoenaed by a court, by a FISA court.
Can I ask you to clarify something? Does the current legal framework in the United States allow for this kind of devices, provided they are created and marketed? It's not going to be illegal, right, to sell and buy and use them?
Which is a great question, and I'll start by saying I'm not a lawyer, but I have read CALEA close enough. CALEA is the Communication Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, and it is written to cover service providers. In the kind of system I'm talking about, there is no actual service provider. It's end-to-end. The endpoints are doing the functionality, and we're simply using the internet as a switching fabric.
You would have a device, you don't have to sign up with AT&T and Verizon, you just go out and use whatever Wi-Fi is out there.
Exactly.
So you wouldn't have a monthly bill either.
Well, that's another benefit.
Well, what if there's no Wi-Fi hotspots?
That's a very good point. If there is no Wi-Fi hotspot and your handset doesn't have the capability to switch to regular cellular, it won't work. So it does depend on a world in which Wi-Fi is available wherever you want to communicate.
So you do have to kind of backstop it with a network, right?
Yes.
Didn't you just say, it'll...
Yes,
right.
Exactly. If we were talking about today's world, yes. When you're out on the road, for example, it's kind of hard to
have
Wi-Fi.
And when you do go into that network, let's say you connect to AT&T, they have some information that somebody's out there.
Yes.
And so you could be tracked with that.
Yes. From my, again, layman's interpretation, an overlay using the technology we've developed on existing cellular would violate CALEA. Mm-hmm. Because AT&T, for example, is certainly a service provider. They charge for their services, and I believe, from what I've read, CALEA would certainly cover their operation. And so the law would actually have to be changed to use the privacy overlay that I've discussed.
You could do some of that now. In other words, you could go out and buy a handset and then connect to any Wi-Fi that you find out there. And then if you're not going through a network provider, then presumably there's nobody there that tracks you. I don't know where that information flows and where that could be intercepted.
Okay, so two different approaches. The first, here we've got a handset that's UMA enabled, and so it's got two ways it can get to the core network. It can use standard cellular, so you've got the cells, and then, or it can use Wi-Fi. Okay. Now, the way things stand now, when you've got a Wi-Fi enabled phone and you make a call through Wi-Fi, it's going to go back to the core network through something called a network controller, and so that's going to record your data. So it's going to know what you connected through, what numbers you're dialing, etc. That's one way, and that's the way it's done now. What I'm suggesting is you simply go out onto the internet from here, and there's nothing collecting your data. You're just another collection of IP packets going out across the internet.
Right, but that's assuming that every place has hotspots, right?
Exactly.
Right, and so I just want to, you probably said this, but I just want to make sure I understand it. In a situation where it would have to bounce between a hotspot and go back to a server or a cell connection in order to keep a continuity, and the way it remains private, is that if I understand it, or encrypted, is that the handheld is not linked to any one identity? Is that what it is?
That's the overlay. So we can do that, but again, we'd have to change CALEA. But if we could do it legally, yes, exactly right. So when you went to your cellular, you'd be using the cellular infrastructure, this top piece, but the infrastructure would not know it was you. All they'd know is I've got some piece of equipment with a random number assigned to it.
Right. Can you do the pros and cons between doing something like this and what people are doing now, which is just buying a burn phone and getting rid of it and within, I don't know, however long the card lasts?
Okay, so let's talk about your standard prepaid phone. You get a phone that you can have, I don't know, several hundred minutes or something like that, and you've paid for it. First thing I want to note, there is pending legislation in Congress that will make those illegal.
Really?
Yeah. Chuck Schumer has sponsored some legislation that says it's actually pretty stiff penalties. And I can provide you with the legislation.
I can find it.
Okay. But let's assume it's still legal. And it is still legal today, as far as I know. What you're doing is you're still creating what I call a location trace. In other words, you've now got this random number, but it's not changing. That random number is fixed. You've got an equipment ID, you've got the phone number associated with the phone, and it starts accumulating data. Mm-hmm. And I very briefly mentioned the information theoretic approach. Basically, what we've shown is that as that location trace reaches a certain point, we know we can associate it with a person, with an individual. We've got enough data, boom, we can go to another database and say, okay, this is who it is. So that's the problem with the prepaid phone. If you only use it for one or two calls and you're not at home, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But if you use it over the course of a week, let's say, that's a lot of data.
How does all this compare with, there are a lot of sort of VoIP things, there's Skype and Google Voice and other things that will take your telephone, your conversation, put that onto a data service as opposed to the mobile network. How does that differ from what you have here in terms of the ability to track and trace, assuming that Skype doesn't just give it away?
Well, that's where I was going to go. Right. One of the issues with Skype is that, well, first off, it's a wonderful service. It works really well. But on the other hand, one of the problems it's got is that it is proprietary. We don't know. We, the public, don't know in detail how it works. And we do know that, for example, Skype has cooperated with the PRISM program. And mm-hmm. we don't know what other data has been provided by Skype to NSA.
But if you had a system that were developed similar to Skype that were open source, would that give you some of that same type of theoretical privacy?
Yes. Yes, it would. So if we could have some way of using random people's computer capacity to handle the connection of the calls and identification of endpoints for those calls, then we could have something approaching what I'm talking about for cellular.
And would that be somehow a sort of actually a software workaround to this, which would be like a broader sense? You'd have to get new kinds of handsets, somebody would have to manufacture mm-hmm. them, and just do a software sort of workaround.
It's an interesting question. I mean, what you'd like is something that would just use what you've already got on your computer,
right.
Assuming you can isolate all the things that are already leaking information,
right.
And somehow some peer-to-peer protocol where there's no central collection of data, that would provide the same benefits. I think it would be hard to isolate stuff on your computer that way. And you'd have to have some means of distributing locations, IP addresses, for example. How do you know I'm at this IP address now? And this morning I was in Ithaca at another IP address. How would that information be collected and used so you could call me? Mm-hmm. That's a hard research problem. That's the sort of thing we're working on.
And the IP addresses can be obviously tracked, right? I mean, so
yes.
That would completely negate that. I mean, you'd have to get some kind of platform or PDA or computer that has... It's anonymous as well.
That's right. And that is a problem that people have been looking at for a while. Tor is a classic solution. It's got its own issues. I don't want to say it's perfect, but it's a very nice solution. Basically, anything that provides encapsulation of IP addresses with other addresses so you can actually hide where you are. An IP address is actually highly localized. If you tell me your IP address, your real IP address, I can tell you pretty accurately you know, at least what town you live in.
Yeah.
And whose services you're using.
To some extent, you can tailor it down to what actual device you're using, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, yeah, and if you're able to match the IP address with what's called the MAC address, then you've got the equipment. Then you've got it all. And so the idea, of course, is to mask all that by encapsulating whatever you have to transmit inside other packets that will hide your IP address.
I asked you earlier how long you think it'll take for some of these products to come to market. You said 2 years. Let me ask the reverse of that. How long do you think it will take for society to want to go to this as opposed to staying with some of their current programs? As you said, people don't even know how to use their current phones, so going to something like Tor or these peer-to-peers can be intimidating for people who aren't, you know, technically savvy. Do you think this will be a generational thing, or do you think that what's happening now has so alarmed people that they will start moving to this kind of technology more quickly and in larger numbers?
Two pieces to that. First, the last part. Yes, I think it's happening now. We've been doing some work with folks in sociology and communications at Cornell, looking at published papers, and with the interest in this material is going up exponentially. Mm-hmm. It's going up really quickly. And just counting articles on the New York Times, for example, there is a tremendous amount of interest that's been generated, and people are getting grumpy about it. So I think it's this generation.
But how does that translate? I mean, people who are doing, you know, clicking on the New York Times stories is different from people who are actually going out and buying some more of this technology. Are you quantifying it like that? I mean, has there been any kind of look-see to see how many people are actually moving towards these new technologies?
Our main data points at the moment have to do with advanced metering infrastructure, which has become a prevalent privacy issue, especially in places like California and Texas. Some other places. So what we're seeing from that is that people are becoming aware of privacy and they're willing to pay for it. Mm-hmm. In fact, Marin County in California actually allows you to opt out of their advanced metering, but you got to pay for it. And people are paying for it, at least in modest numbers.
I'm so sorry, what is advanced metering?
Oh, advanced metering is where they monitor your power consumption every few minutes instead of month by month. So what they can do is vary the price of power over the course of the day to try and motivate you to, you know, dry your clothes at night or stuff like that.
The utility company,
exactly.
Basically. Okay.
Exactly. So there is some interest. And the other part, though, you were asking, you know, I mentioned that most folks don't know, you know, what their cell phone's doing. Mm-hmm. It's pretty complicated. Mm-hmm. But what's going to happen is what happened with the World Wide Web. You know, we'll take something that's actually quite complicated and create interfaces that people can understand and use, because there's going to be a market for it. You know, web browsers. There was a market for web browsers and people did really well
creating
them, making it something that was easy to use. Well, privacy-aware devices can be done the same way.
Yeah. We're not close to that yet, right?
I hope we are. I hope we're within a couple years.
Okay.
Any questions?
Only one question, Kevin.
Huh?
Sorry. I will ask my question on camera.
Oh, okay.
I won't waste your time.
One question before we close. Is it possible to have like a handheld device that is a standard surveillance open cell phone and switch it to a stealth mode or something? Whatever, so it would go right directly to the internet?
That's actually was the first thing I looked at when I was started this research was what I call the privacy overlay. In other words, would there be some way to flip a switch on my phone and suddenly be disassociated? My identity is not connected to this device. It's just a random number. And that was the first problem we solved. That's where we got into this zero knowledge proof issue. You know, how can I show the network that I am who I am, that I've paid my bill, please give me service, without providing my identity? And we solved that problem. It was kind of fun. It again involves public key cryptography and some other computer science concepts. But it's doable. But as we've already talked about, could be illegal at this point for example, Verizon to let me do that. But if I do it on my own and I'm not a service provider and I'm not charging for services, then it's legal, I think.
Tell me, sometimes I've seen some allegations of people that claim to be recorded throughout their telephones. Is there any way that somebody that is watching you can use your camera to see what are you, what you're doing? And is that common, maybe?
Now, there are some things your phone can do without your having to give permission. First off, if your phone is completely powered off, your phone isn't doing anything. It's off, so you're safe. But if your phone is on, the network can command the phone to provide a GPS fix, for example. This is part of the E911 solution, which is arguably very positive. You know, if you can't tell people where you are, but you dial 911, they will find you. I'm not aware that the network can command on your camera, for example. Now, if they could put software in the phone that would allow that, certainly that's easily done. But I'm not aware, just using a basic phone, that that's possible.
So I was at an embassy not long ago. I'll keep it unnamed. But I was told afterwards that if my cell phone had not been off, which it was not, then there was a possibility that it could have been hacked. Which I thought was kind of silly. Some other people thought it was not so silly, but I thought that was a silly, paranoid thing to say. Would that be possible? Could people hack into some of these PDAs that you're discussing that are surveillance-free?
One of the benefits of open source is that the security side is well understood and it's built in the sense that people know what the vulnerabilities are and they continue to solve them. Linux actually handles hackers pretty well for that very reason. So a well-designed, privacy-aware handset shouldn't have these problems, open source developed handset. Mm-hmm. Certainly not more than our current handsets do. One of the problems with existing handsets is that often some service providers, anyway, may use software not fully understanding, you know, all the various parameters and how to set them appropriately. That came up in the carrier IQ issue. So you can create backdoors, for example, accidentally when you develop it if you don't fully understand how it works. So yeah, they can be hacked. It's a computer, you know. And so like any computer, you could download a virus, open the wrong email.
Right.
Is the NSA using all capabilities and possibilities in their surveillance programs? Or they can just get more benefits if they want.
That's not a question I could answer, even if I wanted to. I mean, from what I have seen as a layman, as someone who does not work for the NSA, it looks to me like they're collecting as much as they possibly can. That seems to be an ongoing doctrine, namely get everything and then look for patterns and, you know, and do good things, you know, protect us from attacks and whatnot. But yeah, the desire to collect everything seems to be there. So I would be surprised if there was some trove of data that they were ignoring.
What is your background and how did you come to be interested in this?
Okay, well, I've been in electrical and computer engineering for 30 years. Started out designing satellites for Hughes Aircraft, then went into academia and got interested in sensor networks. Gave a talk on sensor networks 10 years ago, and Berkeley Law School faculty member came up, very nice person, asked me a few questions, and I realized I'd violated everyone's privacy, you know, through the sensor network research I'd done. So that's what got me started. And the problem seemed very interesting, and it's a great way to connect technology and design decisions with downstream sociological, legal, economic issues. In other words, it's all bound together, and so it's just fascinating. That's really how I got here today. That recognition 10 years ago and then following up on it. It's fun stuff.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you all for coming.